We're continuing on in our study of the book of Ecclesiastes. Unfortunately, I can't do with this like I did with the Peters, where we had a nice break and go off on something else for a while. We're just right in the middle of this stuff, and it's kind of hard to break it off. So you bear with me. It's going to be probably fairly short, but you know, when we get to the verse 17, don't start taking out your songbooks, because I'll probably append something to the end of it if I don't get verbose, you know, and get off track. In the book of Ecclesiastes, previously, in the beginning context of chapter 2, Koheleth, or the preacher, had considered all of his construction projects, his enlarged works, housing projects, vineyards, gardens, irrigation channels, and though they were interesting to dream about and plan, and maybe even, you know, to kind of work on as it was involved, still, in the end, it distilled into a transient futility. Further, he also had many slaves, flocks, herds, silver, gold, treasures of kings, and many pleasures of men, more than any other. But in retrospect, it too was culminated in vanity, striving after wind, and he figured to no profit. In this section, we will come back to wisdom and folly, which he had looked into in chapter 1, and we'll draw some more conclusions. Some of you may wonder why, you know, the writers of the Bible, you know, kind of do this, hit a subject and then come back to it. They do it in the New Testament too, like the book of James. And it, some of these things, it's really hard to outline, but it's in many cases the way the Semitic thinking is different, yeah. So it's almost like, as one scholar, you know, drew it, it's almost like you're looking at a slowly, you know, widening spiral as they hit certain topics, go to another one, and then come back and add something to it. And that's what evidently is going on here sometimes. So keep that in mind. And it's a way of, you know, more fully looking at the subject, as we'll see in a moment. So in verse 12, he starts out, "So I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what will a man do who will come after the king except what has already been done?" I turned implies the taking up of a new subject, but strictly speaking, not an entirely new subject, as we just saw, to investigate the actual value of wisdom. Nevertheless, the subject has so many angles, and the previous argumentation may not have fully convinced the gatesayer or, you know, whoever was looking at it, being critical. So he comes back to it. But alas, from another point of view, the same conclusion is reached. So it doesn't matter really where you approach it from, you're going to get, you know, to the same end. The method is again employed of interpreting the thing by reference to its opposite. Wisdom is thought of in relationship to madness and folly, and the clause "for what" is merely an explanation as to why the king undertook the investigation. Since he realized that men who come after him may not deal with the matter as exhaustively and bring it to a clear-cut issue, he proposes to do so. So he's going to settle it, you know, once and for all. In verse 13, he says, "And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness." The writer is going to arrive at the conclusion that purely earthly wisdom is also vanity, but he must concede that even generally speaking, this wisdom has some advantages. You know, why we're capable of it, you know, and using our minds. Although conceding that the wisdom has its uses, even this remarkable treasure falls under the general condemnation of vanity if it is viewed as dealing with purely earthly values. In fact, the add-on is, has something to do with it. The preacher is obviously not condemning all wisdom, for then the scriptures would be at fault. And he does voice the basic claim that there is an advantage to earthly wisdom over folly. And he uses an example even as the advantage of light over darkness. You know, he sheds, you know, some explanation on things. "So the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I know that one fate befalls them both." He now illustrates this, lest he be misunderstood. He seems to be thinking of wisdom on the higher level, and he says of the one who has this gift that his eyes are in his head. That is, he's cranking up even earthly wisdom to a little higher realm, because it may lead to an even higher wisdom, I think. On the other hand, the fool walks in darkness. Perhaps he's considering that the wise man whose eyes are open has a better chance of coming to a greater wisdom of God, yet it stands that he might remain with his worldly wisdom in his arrogance. So, plainly speaking, I think he's saying, you know, the fool is the one that walks in darkness. He's the one that's taken a course that he'll probably never learn. You know, Paul talks about ever learning and ever coming to a knowledge of the truth just because you're coming from a wrong factual base point or unfactual base point. And the fool has kind of chosen the realm of the world anyway. So in this case, you know, even earthly wisdom can give you an advantage if you're smart enough to realize that God is smarter than you are. And so wisdom, you know, with your eyes open, you may get to the point where the preacher is trying to take you is that God's wisdom is something that, you know, it really has value and it's not transient. But again, the problem of wisdom, you know, within every virtue, someone said, is the seeds of its own destruction. When somebody starts getting there thinking they're really smart, there's an arrogance that will also keep them from, you know, turning to God. And then they become like the fool. So what's what follows this is an indictment. He can, by his own observation, verify the fact that as far as these two men are concerned, the wise and the foolish, again, earthly wisdom, the one fate befalls them both. And this is plain. It doesn't matter how smart you are, what your IQ points are, or whatever. In the end, if all you've relied upon is worldly wisdom, you're just as dumb as the fool. Death claims you both, and what advantage has all the knowledge that you've accumulated? What good does it do you? There was an interesting. I started watching on Hulu some really old TV series from England, and one of them is Sherlock Holmes. Actually, it's kind of interesting, but there was a quotation in there where Dr. Watson, you know, is telling Holmes about the Earth revolving around the sun. And Sherlock Holmes looks up and goes, "What, really?" Watson goes, "You don't know that?" And he goes, "No," and this was the point, "I don't take the time to learn things that have no significant value in my life." You know, the explanation, the fact that you know that the Earth goes around the sun, does that do you any good at all? I mean, does your knowledge of it increase your advantage in any way, in any form? And I thought that's an interesting yardstick to put to anything. Put it to evolution. If evolution was true, so what? It can't be repeated. It has nothing to do with science. It contradicts most of the principles of science. You can't put it in a test tube. You can't make a new product out of it. So what good's the knowledge? Except as a detrimental form, to waste. A lot of money going in and out of space trying to prove something that doesn't happen, or just trying to diss God, which does make a big difference in your life, which is what Koheleth is trying to tell us. In the Hebrew, there is a parenthetical, that we don't see it in the English, a typical expression by the preacher when he wishes to raise an objection to a view that is currently held. Though men may think that their worldly insight makes them special, Koheleth knows that their fate is no different than that of a fool's. Stop to think about it. The wisest people that you know, Einstein or whatever, have they been able to add 1 minute to their life by all their knowledge? Have they been able to save their immortal souls by what they know? Not if it has nothing to do with, with God. So then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? This is something, if we're taking Solomon's perspective, what did all of his wisdom bring him to? When it got away from God, it got him away from salvation. So the translator translates the Hebrew word, why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. The translator translates the Hebrew word, mikra, as fate, but Some are want to avoid this term, and for a good reason. Right? They prefer the word lot, which would then be here. You know, the idea, you understand, whatever, whether it's fate or lot, it would be death. The problem with the word fate, though, is it's a pagan concept that refers to some dark, mysterious power, even beyond God's reach, and above his control, that does not fit here at all. So we're going to steer away from fate. In fact, there's a few words that we kind of pick up that probably as Christians we shouldn't. Another one, I was looking at this, I was thinking of the word, we wish each other luck. Another pagan concept. That actually has to do with having a certain god in your life, making changes. Luck is, we don't go by luck, especially dumb luck. But we go by God's providence and his power through prayer. death is here the great leveler, where one might expect that God would take cognizance of the fact that one man tried harder than others to increase his wisdom and thus be exempt from death. Is not the way it works, and especially under the sun. No man has learned to increase his life into eternity, so this remains vanity. However, life with God, this is why we say it may look like a sameness in life under the sun. When you put God in the equation, it throws it all off. Life with God in it can be eternal. God has at times taken control over this lot or fate or death or whatever, and either kept men from dying, like Enoch, Elijah, or raised them from the dead, Lazarus, Tabitha, Jesus, all those that came out of the grave after Jesus' resurrection in Matthew. And so God is outside the realm of things under the sun. This is why it's interesting for us and should concern us. So 16, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. Another pertinent observation is now added, not only is the fool doomed to die and be forgotten, but so evidently is the wise man. How many truly wise men have lived in history, and we don't know a thing about them? Especially in troublesome times where governments or whatever, start putting pressure on, from Russian, Soviet society, a lot of, good thinkers got, sent off to an archipelago, Siberia, and never heard of again. Probably some of them very brilliant thinkers. For a lot of communist states, I know when, after we left Vietnam, and the Chi Com took over, or the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia, the first thing they did was line up everybody with any sort of degree, intelligence, political background, and shot them. It doesn't make the news that much. And the more people have died in communist countries from purges, than any kind of religious wars that have ever gone on. One would think it more proper for the fool to be forgotten and the wise man remembered. Then too, in the coming days, if hard times are implied, it would make no difference whether it's one of wise or fool, or both forgotten. In fact, one of the things that was kind of interesting is, even in our society, I don't know if you heard about the thing in Texas, where they decided to redo the textbooks. One little object that was left out of them, history textbooks, was Thomas Edison. They didn't think him important enough, as part of our history. Okay. A little memorial to Thomas Edison. Turn off your TV. Don't watch a motion picture. And turn off your lights. This man has had a significant effect in our culture. Okay. But they don't want to remember him in the textbooks. Okay. Just as they don't want to remember Jesus Christ anymore. He's had more effect on humanity than any other person that's come down the pike. In fact, in death, no one will be able to draw the conclusion as to whether an individual governed himself with wisdom or not if both are dead. You don't know how smart the guy was. So what difference does it make? So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. So the conclusion, therefore, I was disgusted with life, because something that is under the sun seemed wrong to me, for everything is vanity and striving. I use the word disgusted. Translation disgusted is more in keeping with the English idiom than the more literal, I hated life. And, I mean, not just I hated, but it was just, you just saw things that went bad and were detrimental to everybody. Here's something must again be reiterated and kept in mind. Cohelius is not considering all wisdom, inclusive of God's wisdom, but only that which is purely man's. And when we're looking at, you know, wise men, you know, wise in their own estimation, there's a reason why a lot of psychologists and stuff have a tendency to commit suicide, because they think that's all there is. But only what is purely man's, and that's operating under the sun. No living according to God's wisdom could ever be considered as disgusting. In fact, it's what gives spice to life. It's what makes life better. And again, we'll get to that in a moment. But life can only be then, under God's wisdom, pure, holy, special, and enriching. If you don't believe that, how familiar are you with the films that come out of Hollywood? There was a period of time when religion had a control over the things that came out. I mean, you can see this. If you go back even before the film codes, you'd be surprised at just how raunchy some of our superstars were before they were put under a code. I mean, a lot of them, we think, oh, nice, sweet, innocent, and all that kind of stuff. When there was no code, these people were pure prostitutes. They would do anything to get on film. When the code was there, you got a lot of good moral stuff coming out. There was a point to the stories. You know, there was, in many cases, happy endings, you know, a good value to life, in most cases anyway. When they decided to get rid of the code, in fact, when the Catholic Church pulled out and said it's just too cost, it's not cost effective enough for us to keep, evaluating every movie, Hollywood actually asked them to keep doing it, because they knew one thing. When you start taking the codes off, you're going to get really stupid, disgusting films that nobody wants to watch. And you're going to get saturated with them. And that's what we have now. Now, a lot of those movies that come out, you go, what was the point of that? You know, really stupid, raunchy, whatever. There's nothing to cheer for that doesn't leave you, uplifted. And that's the thing about the Christian life. It uplifts the arts. It makes things more enriching, more appreciable. And you don't get that, with life under the sun. And so this is the summary. And so where are we? Okay, we've got a few minutes. And kind of a part of an invitation here. Let me kind of qualify this, before we get into it. It's going to have something to do with government, but not politics. Well, maybe a little bit about politics. But it's, when I grew up, I still find it in some congregations, it's like, politics, government was off limits. And we grew up with the assumption that there was a separation of church and state. We just thought, that's what the Constitution said. Nobody told us otherwise. To justify this, I want to bring out whatever. First of all, if the church is to have nothing to do with government, Romans 13, 1 through 7 shouldn't be in the Bible. Okay, it talks about it as being an institution of God, just as the family is an institution of God. Okay, when God spoke to Abraham, he said he would bless many nations. Now, how are you going to bless a nation without putting God's principles in it? Same with the family. If you think that as an institution, it has no thinking at all in the church, then don't apply God's principles in your family and see how it turns out. Okay? In fact, the more you think about it, just about every situation in the Old and New Testament has to do with either prophets or apostles dealing with government. I mean, Paul's mission was to go before kings. Now, as you look at the Old Testament, it's like, you know, we go from one nation to another, and prophecies of God deal with nations. And it tells us God raises them up and he pulls them down. And this is something to think about, okay? But even more specifically about our own selves and how, you know, we deal with it. This last week, I don't know if you're aware of it, we were supposed to have a day of prayer on the 6th, you know, which kind of got scuttled one way or the other. But it's interesting, even from the beginning of this nation, there was no difference, you know, no separation, you know, that they talk about now. In 1775, even before this was a nation, on the eve of the Revolution, the First Continental Congress called for a day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer. Okay. Now, there's a reason for this. Because our founding fathers, as far as they were concerned, we wouldn't have a country if it wasn't for the providence of God. There were so many, just, you know, you might just call them weird things that went on, that there's no way we should have been a nation. I mean, think about it. All we were, you know, only a third of the people were, you know, really in the fight. You know, it was on their own territory. They had to leave their farms. They lost a lot of their possessions, their family, and everything else. It was a ragtag, you know, little army that went against the mightiest army and navy in the world at the time. In fact, Washington's army had just run out of funds anyway. And the guys were ready to go home. The only reason they didn't is because of what Washington said to them. Brother, I think I mentioned it here, but there's something that used to be taught consistently in our schools that isn't brought up anymore. And that's just the life of Washington himself. The guy was like the epitome of morals. In fact, he used to keep like 18 little commandments on his sleeve, and he referred to them just about, you know, once every hour, of how, what kind of a character he was supposed to be. He was, you know, admittedly not the smartest bulb, you know, in the package, but the really smart ones in the Continental Congress figured this guy was the epitome of what we want this nation to stand for, and that's why he was made president. And if you want to know the providence behind all this, I think I told you about that old Indian that came up to him. Remember that? When, before he was president in the French and Indian War, he led a troop on a scout. He and some other officers, they were on horseback and a bunch of foot soldiers, and they were ambushed. Okay. All the other officers were shot out of the saddle because the Indians were told by the French to concentrate their fire on the officers. Washington was the only one that didn't get hit. In fact, after the battle, he had 18 holes in his jacket from bullets, and not one of them touched him. The Indian that came up to him 15 years later, he just wanted to see, says, I want to meet the man who the Great Spirit was with. Because he said, up until that time, I've never missed a shot. I mean, these guys were good, you know, hitting game on the run. He says, I shot at you 5 times and missed every time. As far as, you know, people were concerned, you know, Washington lived not a charm life, but one blessed by God. There was some reason in seeing that God wanted him around. And that's the same for this country. Just providential evidence after providential evidence seemed to be that God was behind the beginning of this. And you can see it in the writings of some of the fathers. We're going to look at this. John Adams declared May 9th, 1798, as a day of solemn humiliation, fasting, and prayer, that our country may be protected from all the dangers which threaten it. They were looking to God to help them still. Our fathers were greatly and rightly suspect of any encroachment by government upon religious freedom, and codified that prescription in Article 1 of our Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's your constitutional right. If you want to exercise your religion, as long as you're not hurting somebody else, your right in the Constitution says you can do that. In other words, Congress may not mandate that a particular religion is nationalized and others be prohibited. Our founders were not radical secularists, far from it. One need only examine their many writings on the subject as evidence, but rightly, they didn't want the United States to be wedded with a particular church. That's the only thing they were going for, as was the case with England and the Anglican Church. Now, when they tell you that Thomas Jefferson was an atheist, it's a malicious lie. Jefferson, a vigilant though skeptical Anglican, made clear his prohibition in his obscure but maliciously misconstrued 1802 letter to the Danbury Baptist Association. Far from calling for a coercive stripping of all religious influences from the public life, Jefferson merely assured the Baptist constituents in Connecticut that their denominational practices were safe because our Constitution provided a wall of separation. That is, the wall is constructed by the Constitution to keep government out of religion, not the other way around. In fact, they wanted an intrusion of government of religion into government. Notably, 2 days after writing that letter, Jefferson attended religious services in the House of Representatives. They held church in the House. But James Madison wrote, our Constitution, the one he penned, does not bar the government from designating particular days for religious worship throughout the state. Yeah. If we want to have a day of prayer, that's our God-given right, as far as they were concerned. However, in the latter half of the 20th century, judicial activists, what Jefferson called the despotic branch, in fact, there was a reason why they put him in the cellar. That's where the chief justices met. And in fact, even they were a little bit shaky when they started to build their own house for him in the Supreme Court. He was afraid that that they would begin to interpret the First Amendment to suit their political agendas, placing ever more severe constraints upon the free exercise of religion, while wholly misrepresenting the aforementioned wall of separation in a concerted effort to expel religious practice from any and all public forms. Okay? And that's where government is headed. The right now, as it stands, the Supreme Court pretty much has nullified the legislative and executive branch. You can see that even more in California, where the constituents can vote for something and one guy on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal can just dismiss it as if he's got more smarts than anybody else. They have done so by falsely putting forth a living constitution, a revisionist document which has little resemblance to the authentic constitution that was once the republic standard of rule of law. Now, what happens if you have a constitution, it's a living constitution? That means you can take it any way you want to. And it's not a new thing. We got there because they want to look at the Bible as a living document. That is, it was fine for 2,000 years ago, but it's not fine anymore. And we need to reinterpret God's word or trash it, or whatever we need to, in order to update it to modern times. Garbage, strictly. Okay. Rules of law are put in place for that very reason, so they don't change them. And this is what a republic is. It's a state with a rule of law, so that nobody can come along, get a mass of votes, and change everything to the detriment of what we know is right and what is right. In fact, as noted by former Chief Justice William Rehnquist, the wall of separation between church and state as a metaphor is based upon bad history, a metaphor which has proved useless as a guide to judging. It should be frankly and explicitly abandoned. I mean, this is a Supreme Court justice saying, forget about this concept of separation of church and state. The greatest injury of the wall notion is its mischievous diversion of judges from the actual intention of the drafters of the Bill of Rights. They don't care about the context or original intent anymore. The intended consequences of this artificial barrier between church and state is to remove the unmistakable influence of our Creator from all public forums, particularly government education institutes, and thus over time to disabuse belief in a sovereign God and the notion of natural rights. The erosion of knowledge about the origin of our rights, the very foundation of our country and basis of our Constitution, has dire implications for the future of our essential liberty. When the judges take over, you're going to lose your rights. And you've already lost most of them so far. In 1952, Congress established the National Day of Prayer as an annual event by a joint resolution signed into law by President Harry Truman. And it calls for a nation to turn to God in prayer and meditation. Naturally, the despotic branch is challenging that resolution, asserting that religion and politics don't mix. Not according to God. They should mix. Christianity should have control over every aspect of our life. Our founding fathers realized that. That ruling, of course, has no basis in our Constitution, but merely among those who have contorted its meaning, true meaning, to a grotesque remnant of its original brilliance. Perhaps they should look into the depth of faith that motivated the actions of our patriot founders. John Hancock, Roger Sherman, John Dickinson, Hugh Williamson, Benjamin Rush, Samuel Huntington, John Adams, William Williams, Robert Treat Paine, Rufus King, William Livingston, James Wilson, George Mason, and Patrick Henry. I bet you don't even know who most of those people are. Here are but a few examples of our founders' expressions of their faith when in positions of authority. unless it'll be yours. Hancock called on his home state of Massachusetts to pray that universal happiness may be established in the world and that all may bow to the scepter of our Lord Jesus Christ and the whole earth be filled with his glory. This is our founding fathers. According to John Adams, the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and as immutable as the existence and attributes of God. The Christian religion is above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. It's going along with what we're studying in Ecclesiastes. If we're just running this nation like under the sun, it's going to die. In fact, it's in its death throes now if we don't turn it around. Patrick Henry wrote, "The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that have ever that were ever printed. The great pillars of all government and of social life are virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible." Samuel Adams called on Massachusetts to pray that we may with one heart and voice humbly implore his gracious and free pardon through Jesus Christ, supplementing his divine aid, and above all, to cause the religion of Jesus Christ in its true spirit to spread far and wide till the whole earth shall be filled with its glory. America was designed to be the center of the Christian faith and to take it into the rest of the world. Truly, the world is a better place because of their design and purpose. Even those who are cautious about public expressions of religion left evidence of their views on Christianity. Thomas Jefferson, again, that old atheist, wrote, "I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wishes anyone to be, sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others. I am a real Christian, that is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus Christ." You see, Jefferson's been misrepresented through our history books. Ben Franklin wrote, "As to Jesus of Nazareth, I think the system of morals and his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see." Beyond these many writings, as if further proof were needed, our founders unequivocally enumerated the natural rights of all men in our Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. The freedom you have as an American is given to you as far as they were concerned because God says you've got these rights. You take God out of it and you lose your rights. And this is what they're gearing this country toward. Notably, the conviction that our rights are innately bestowed by the laws of nature and nature's God is enumerated, and you've probably seen this on the internet. You know, I've got a copy if you want. I've even got a copy of the Constitution of the State of California. Look at the preamble of every state constitution. All of them pretty much state. In fact, California goes, this Constitution is established to preserve the blessings of God upon it. Personally, you know, if you become a very good lawyer, you could pretty much have recalled or, impeached probably every public official that ever took an oath to preserve the Constitution, either of the state he's in or the nation he serves. Thomas Jefferson proclaimed, "The God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. Can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated, but with His wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that His justice cannot sleep forever." If you need an interpretation of that, even back then, when people were devoutly, really, just about everybody read from the Bible, and that's what Count Tocqueville, you know, said when he came over. You know, he wanted to see why our republic was working in France as well, wasn't. And he noted the difference is we were all God-fearing people. And if it was true even back then, this is why we're going in Samuel, you know, pointed out the fact that just how much faith David and Jonathan had in God and worked with Him through every occurrence. That's exactly what our founding fathers were like. And we're losing that. And, you know, I know there's big hope, you know, perhaps, well, you know, we'll get all the liberals out, you know, come this November or something like that and start to take back things. And looking back to a conservative form of government, well and good, but it's not going to bring it back unless God is in the mix. And it starts, you know, let me bring it back to, you know, where it's pertinent to us. It brings it back to us. Who would have saved Sodom and Gomorrah? Do you remember your Bible stories? What would have taken to save Sodom and Gomorrah? Five, ten, whatever. Righteous people. Okay. If you want to go along with the flow of the way this nation is going, you can bet you're going to aid in its demise. However, if you maintain your righteousness, we may be the only ones that actually preserve this country. The only reason God has to keep it going. Okay. And that's what Ecclesiastes is trying to tell us. It's all important that we make sure that our relationship with God is intact, that we are being the best possible Christians we can be because the life of the planet depends on it. I mean, just think of the bottom line. If there's no more righteous people on this planet, there's no reason for God to preserve it. If you need help in any way, let us know. You know, that's what we're here to do. This is the community of God to look after His institutions, the family, the government, and especially the church. I mean, even as you're thinking of government, the church is God's government now. It doesn't take away from the others, you know, governments being a part of His institution, but the church especially. You know, that's His kingdom. And we really need to be working to preserve it. You know, in its purity. Okay, for, in fact, that's what the, in fact, I skipped over one quote, the one by John Adams. his conclusion was, where Christianity is a religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. He says, suppose a nation in some distant region should take the Bible for their own law book, and every member should relegate his conduct by the precepts those exhibited. What a utopia. What a paradise would this region be? Yeah. And this one point, he missed it. That's what God's trying to have us do with the church. The kingdom of God, the church, is his utopia. It should be a paradise on earth, a light set on the hill. And this is what we need to make it. And that's what you need to give serious consideration to this week, in the week following, in the months ahead, in the years ahead. How can you channel your life, especially you young people? I mean, this is what it's geared. Ecclesiastes is geared like the wisdom literature, especially for the young. What are you going to do with your life? What are you going to do to fight for God's principles? That's the challenge. What can you do for God? The invitation is yours.